first of a three-part series entitled Covenant, the Story of a Biblical Pattern. This is the theme for these 3 days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, at 8:30 or as soon thereafter as we can make it after breakfast. Now, I have chosen this theme for one of the series because the National Council of Churches has made it the study theme for the adult classes which churches across the nation might wish to put on during the year 1978-79. And they have also commissioned 2 or 3 paperbacks which are to be used in connection with this theme. One of them I have here. It was done by myself and a colleague of mine. My own name appears and that of Rosemary Ruther, entitled The Liberating Bond, Covenants, Biblical and Contemporary. Then there is another one entitled Promises to Keep, a Workbook of Experience for Covenant Living, done by a couple, Dennis and Marilyn Benson. And then one that puts it all into a global perspective by Carothers, Caring for the World. At any rate, this is one of the reasons why I have chosen this topic for one of the Bible study series I'm doing here at Holden. The other reason, and a very obvious one, is that the covenant theme is indeed a very important one, both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. You know, and you heard it again last night when we celebrated the Eucharist, that Jesus at the Last Supper said with reference to the cup, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood." And here indeed you have the covenant theme very prominent. Now, what I would like to do is to discuss with you today what a covenant is according to the understanding of the Old Testament. There are a good many texts in the Old Testament, and so I have to pick and choose in order to get you some representative texts that highlight the whole range of meaning of the word covenant. I will then ask, and I also intend to do this today, what is the purpose of people entering into covenant relationships with each other? What is effected by their being in covenant relationship? And I will illustrate that with references to passages in the Old Testament. Then tomorrow I will deal with a related subject. While in the New Testament we hear a lot about the new covenant, and come to think of it, in the book of Jeremiah we already hear of a new covenant, we also hear in the Old Testament a lot about an eternal covenant. So tomorrow I would like to discuss with you the notion of an eternal covenant that is prominent in some passages of the Old Testament and which later became the covenant theology of the synagogue of Judaism, the great sister communion, if you wish. And then on Wednesday I will complete the series by discussing with you the notion of the new covenant, beginning with the exilic prophets, especially Jeremiah, but then running on into the intertestamental period and, of course, the New Testament. Now, so much for the outline of what I intend to do today, tomorrow, and on Wednesday. Each presentation, of course, can be taken and heard in its own right, but the 3 of them are meant to fit together in the way in which I have just indicated that. So if you have planned a hike for tomorrow, don't be afraid, you can readily gear back into my presentations on Wednesday. Now let me come to the first part of the series, namely what a covenant is. And rather than giving you elaborate definitions at the outset, let us look at 3 texts in the Old Testament in which we hear of covenants. The first text to which we turn is 1 Samuel 18, 1 through 3. 1 Samuel 18, 1 through 3. Let me quickly fill you in on the context. These chapters in the first book of Samuel deal with the young David and his phenomenal rise to power. You know that it was a long journey for him to become king of Judah and Israel, and that he began really as a musical entertainer at the court of his predecessor Saul. You also recall that Saul had a son, Jonathan, evidently a very capable young man, and very soon the two became close friends. That was a strange connection, after all, because you might expect Jonathan to be very jealous of David, Jonathan, the king's son. But not so. We hear that the two became friends, and that's now where 1 Samuel 18 begins. 1 Samuel 18, verses 1 through 3. I am using various translations. This happens to be the New English Bible, now available in a very convenient study edition, Oxford Study Edition, the New English Bible with Apocrypha, both available as a hardbound book and as a well-bound paperback. Here we read, that same day when Saul had finished talking with David, he kept him and would not let him return any more to his father's house, for he saw that Jonathan had given his heart to David and had grown to love him as himself. So Jonathan and David made a solemn covenant or compact, because each loved the other as dearly as himself. In other words, the relationship of friendship that already obtains between the two is now firmed up through a solemn compact agreement covenant. And Jonathan stripped off the cloak he was wearing and his tunic and gave them to David, together with his sword, his bow, and his belt. Now that is all I would like to read from this particular passage. Let me comment on one or two aspects of this passage. Evidently, it is not enough to be friend with each other in order to be secure with each other. Friendship is certainly the beginning and the basis of that relationship, but it needs to be firmed up. It needs to be solemnly initiated into a relationship that from now on will securely bind the two. If you would like to know how that covenant between these two people later affected their lives to the point of saving David's life, then you have to read the following chapters, and that we cannot do here. By the way, all this, chapter 18 and the surrounding texts, are part of a larger literary work, the story of David's rise to power. Many interpreters of the Old Testament think that it is a very old story, maybe from the time of David himself. And you find it in 1 Samuel 15, the second half of the chapter, all the way through 2 Samuel 5. If you were in a seminary class, this would be probably your first assignment to read this at home. But this is not a seminary class. Now to return to this particular passage. We heard of this initiation of the covenant and of an interesting rite that accompanied the initiation of that covenant, namely that Jonathan gave his own clothes, evidently symbolically, not that he stood naked then, but gave his own clothes and weapons to David. In other words, covenants are initiated through tangible rites. You will hear more about this. For the time being, it is enough to note that. A third point. How could one describe, in one's own words, the quality, the character of this relationship that has been initiated, established through entering into a covenant? Let me try this on for size. A covenant makes people, individuals and or communities, brothers and sisters of each other. Brothers and sisters of each other. If you want, you can put in parentheses before brothers and sisters, fictitious, but that's not terribly important. We have a few Old Testament texts that indicate that between blood brothers and sisters, between parents and children, no covenant relationship needs to be initiated. It is there, so to speak, congenitally. It is something already given with their being brothers and sisters or parents and children. So much for the first passage. Now the second passage to which I would like to turn is found in the book of Genesis, chapter 31. Chapter 31, verses 43 through 54. Genesis 31, 43 through 54. Again, of course, this passage is taken out of context, and I have to fill you in on the context. The context of Genesis 31 are the Jacob stories, the stories about the ancestor of Israel, the father of the 12 tribes of Israel. And you also recall that Jacob had a very checkered career with some dark and some light sides to it, like having to run away from home and then going to his uncle in Mesopotamia. And here in chapter 31, we read of the encounter between him and his uncle Laban, who had pursued him after Jacob had run away also from there. Laban finally caught up with Jacob, and he reprimands him severely. You have taken away my daughters, you have taken them like prisoners of war. Well, that's somewhat of an exaggeration, but then both Jacob and Laban speak in very strong terms, and you know how to read this. To make a long story short, finally Laban suggests to Jacob that they settle, that they regularize, that they put on a firm basis this rather odd relationship that had obtained between the two of them until then. Now this is the context of Genesis 31. Let me again read the passage from my study edition here of the New English Bible. Laban answered Jacob, "The daughters are my daughters." He refers, of course, to Leah and Rachel. "The children, their children, are my children. The flocks are my flocks. All that you see is mine. But as for my daughters, what can I do today about them and the children they have borne? Come now, we will make an agreement. We will make a covenant, you and I, and let it stand as a witness between us." So Jacob chose a great stone and set it upright as a sacred pillar. Then he told his kinsmen to gather stones, and they took them and built a cairn, and there beside the cairn they ate together. Laban called it Jegar Sahaduta. Now that is an Aramaic word that has simply been transliterated. And Jacob called it Galed, which is the same word only in Hebrew, namely a heap, understand, of stones that is a witness. Laban said, "This cairn is witness today between you and me." For this reason it was named Galed. It was also named Mitzpah, for Laban said, "May the Lord watch between you and me when we are parted from each other's sight." And now listen to the stipulations of that agreement, of that compact. "If you ill-treat my daughters or take other wives beside them, when no one is there to see, then God be witness between us." Laban said further to Jacob, "Here is this cairn, and here the pillar which I have set up between us. This cairn is witness, and the pillar is witness. I, for my part, will not pass beyond this cairn to your side." Another stipulation surfaces here, namely that Laban and his Arameans will stay to the east side. It is, in other words, a boundary stone. Jacob with his people will stay on the west side. "And you, for your part, shall not pass beyond this cairn in this pillar to my side to do an injury. Otherwise, the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, his own God, will judge between us." And Jacob swore this oath in the name of the fear of Isaac, his father. That's an old name for the God of Israel. He slaughtered an animal for sacrifice. Now here, of the solemn initiation, in this case, even a sacrifice is carried out there in the hill country, and summoned his kinsmen to the feast. A sacrifice, of course, means a great feast. The two go together usually. So they ate together and spent the night there. now their unsure, insecure relationship until then has been settled. They have entered into a covenant relationship. And again, we hear of solemn rites that initiate the covenant. We hear of stipulations that lay out the way in which the partners are now to relate to each other. And we hear of a sacred meal. What is different in this text in relation to the earlier one that refers to David and Jonathan is that here the covenant is made not only between two individuals, but also binds their people, their descendants, their tribe, or their family. In other words, covenants do not only relate individual human beings to each other, they also, and in fact, as far as the Old Testament is concerned, primarily relate communities to each other and establish a firm relationship between the two of them. Make them as brothers and sisters. Now let me turn to the third passage I would like to discuss, where we hear of a covenant, but here the partner at first isn't so clear at all. The passage will have to speak for itself. It is Genesis 15. Genesis 15, 7 following. What is the context here? In Genesis 15, we are told one of the stories about Abraham. Abraham, the father of Israel. In fact, all the chapters from Genesis 12 through 25 are about Abraham. In Genesis 15, we are told that after Abraham had entered the land of promise, then a very strange event occurred to him. Again, let me read the passage. Genesis 15, 7 following. I'm beginning with the sixth verse, Emma, for the sake of context. Abraham put his faith in the Lord, and the Lord counted that faith to him as righteousness. He said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out from Ur of the Chaldees to give you this land to occupy. He has entered the land of promise. He has come from Mesopotamia, whence God called him. Abraham said, O Lord God, how can I be sure that I shall occupy it? You see here again the element of uncertainty characterizes the state of affairs. How can I be sure that your promise, your call, is really something on which I can rely? The Lord answered, bring me a heifer 3 years old, a she-goat 3 years old, a ram 3 years old, a turtle dove, and a fledgling. He brought him all these, and now listen, halved the animals down the middle and placed each piece opposite its corresponding piece, but he did not half the birds. So you have a very strange sight here. On the desert floor are laid out animals cut into halves. One half of the animal here, the other half there, and so three animals, one after another. That creates a strange road in between, does it not? But the other two animals of which we hear were not cut. When the birds of prey swooped down on the carcasses, Abraham scared them away. By way of footnote, let me confess that most Old Testament interpreters don't quite know what to make with that particular verse. It's not of great importance for our purposes. Then, as the sun was going down, a trance, a deep sleep. It's the same word that is used in Genesis chapter 2 when out of Adam's rib Eve is created. God let a trance, a deep sleep, fall over him. And it's used only in these two places in the Old Testament. It's a very rare Hebrew word. A trance came over Abraham and great fear came upon him. The Lord said to Abraham, know this for certain, that your descendants will be aliens living in a land that is not theirs. They will be slaves and will be held in oppression there for 400 years. But I will punish that nation whose slaves they are, And after that they shall come out with great processions. You yourself shall join your fathers in peace and be buried in a good old age. And the fourth generation shall return here, for the Amorites will not be ripe for punishment till then. The sun went down, and it was dusk, and there appeared a smoking fire pot. That's the only way in which we can translate it. Some translations translate it with torch, evidently some fiery element that is visible, and a flaming torch passing between the divided pieces. And here comes our word. That very day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, and he said, to your descendants I give this land from the river of Egypt. That's not the Nile, by the way. That is a small river south of Gaza. From that small river south of Gaza to the great river. That's the bend of the Euphrates, a little bit to the northeast of Damascus. The territory of the Kenites and the Kenizzites and the Kadmonites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Rephaim and the Amorites and the Canaanites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Now this is the last of the three passages I would like to discuss with you in order to indicate to you the Old Testament understanding of what a covenant is. First of all, again we notice in this passage an element of insecurity, uncertainty at the beginning, and that the concluding of a covenant is made in order to overcome this uncertainty. Abraham is not sure. How will he know that God indeed will keep his promise? And then God's promise is solemnly confirmed through the covenant rite, the covenant initiation. More, we hear here of a covenant initiation that is different from the ones we had encountered earlier. Mind you, it seems that here the covenant partners are not two individual human beings, nor two human communities, but really Abraham on the one side and his descendants, and God himself on the other side. In other words, we deal here not with an inter-human covenant relationship, but with a human-divine covenant relationship. And in that respect, this passage again is quite different from the two preceding ones. It is not different in that the covenant is initiated through a solemn rite. That is the same in all cases, even though the rites themselves differ quite a bit, one from the other. Easily, this is the strangest of all rites. By the way, we have another passage in the Old Testament where we hear of a covenant initiation that refers to the halving of animals. For those of you who are interested, check the 34th chapter of the book of Jeremiah. It's quite a different context, quite a different setting, but it is basically the same rite. What's more, in ancient documents that come from the lands around the Bible, ancient Mesopotamia, ancient Syria, we hear of similar covenant initiations, of halving of animals, of burning of wax figures. And in all cases is said what is also said clearly in Jeremiah 34. These are symbolic actions. May those who now enter the covenant be always holy in covenant relationship with each other. If they are not, may it happen to them as it happened to these animals that were cut into two, or in the text from Sephirah, which students in Old Testament studies know very well, may they become like these wax figures that are now burnt. Of course, you can imagine that Old Testament scholars have a great time with these various covenant initiation rites and all the details, the strange details that they portray. But this is not our primary interest here. What can we conclude from this summary or this review of these three passages? A covenant is initiated, so we learn from the Old Testament, between individual human beings, or between human communities, or between the divine, between the God of Israel and his people, in this particular case, Abraham and his descendants. In other words, a covenant is a pattern that can be applied to various aspects of individual and communal and religious life. In other words, it's a very comprehensive pattern. And it would be very easy to multiply examples from the Old Testament, the intertestamental writings, the early Jewish and the early Christian writings, showing how widespread the notion of covenant was. You probably are aware of the fact that our word testament is nothing but a Latin translation of the Greek word diatheke, which in turn, in most cases, is a translation of the Hebrew word berit, covenant. In other words, the word covenant is one of the most everyday terms of the Christian tradition, in that we refer to our scriptures as the Old Covenant, the Old Testament, and the New Testament, the New Covenant. That's point one. It is evidently a very comprehensive and widespread pattern of ordering relationships. Second point, flowing directly from it, covenants are initiated when the situation otherwise is very insecure, uncertain. Now remember, these ancients lived in a world that was very insecure and uncertain on many counts. We have made, for better or for worse, our world much more predictable. We can plan with a calendar. I'm doing it all the time. What is to happen tomorrow and the weekends and the month ends and maybe a year hence. For the ancients, life was much more precarious. You could never be sure when you would be struck by the plague or by hunger or by famine or by the enemy or I do not know what. You could never be sure of other tribes and human beings. And so the covenant is one way of overcoming this chaos in interhuman relationships. The covenant is really, in that respect, part of God's creative work, bringing order out of chaos. And what is more, it is an order that is established not just for the moment, here and now, as much as it is established for here and now, it is an order that is to bind the covenant partners into a relationship, and this is the most important point, that affirms each partner, that is the opposite of destruction and chaos. A covenant relationship tends to, builds, constructs, maintains, fosters life in fullness for the covenant partners. It is a life in mutuality and loyalty to each other. True, stipulations go with it as to how the covenant partners are to relate to each other. But when you now remember what I said earlier, that a covenant brings people into a brother, 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 sister, sister, sister relationship, you immediately realize that this relationship is not primarily governed by a set of laws, few or many, but rather is governed by the constant sensitivity of one partner to the other. It is a very flexible relationship, and yet a relationship that is characterized by, and here I'm simply using the Hebrew terms that are used, being whole with each other, being upright with each other, being perfect with each other. And the word I have translated whole or upright or perfect are often expressed in Hebrew with the word shalom, which you have probably heard many a time. Shalom, often translated peace, well-being, welfare, mutuality in loyalty, and you can go on with these paraphrases. Now this brings me to the end of my presentation today. If I had a little bit more time, I would indicate to you how at a certain period in the history of ancient Israel, this covenant understanding that we find in many places in the Old Testament, in many texts, coalesced into a covenant theology. In other words, we hear in the book of Deuteronomy, the fifth book of the Old Testament, we hear what many of us think are preachers expounding what you might call a theology of the covenant, where the legacy of thinking in terms of covenant came together, I'm tempted to say, into a system, a theological system comparable to the great systems in theology that we know from the history of the synagogue and of the church, but I certainly wouldn't want to put heavy emphasis on the word system there, into a coherent whole where Israel is understood and addressed as the covenanted people of the Lord. In other words, it follows from this understanding here in Genesis 15. And we find it then in these mini sermons that you have in the book of Deuteronomy, especially between chapter 6 and chapter 11, unfolded in different ways. Listen to just one example. In a way, it's my favorite passage from the book of Deuteronomy. It is found in Deuteronomy chapter 7. 7 through 11. Deuteronomy 7, 7 through 11. It is one of the many sermons of these Deuteronomic preachers unfolding the notion of the covenant and of Israel's election. Now, to be sure, the word covenant itself is not used in this particular passage, but there's little doubt in my mind that the preacher here describes the life force of God's covenantal relationship to his people and of their response in mutuality to the God of Israel. You can really hear the preachers leaning over the pulpit here. It was not because you were more numerous than any other nation that the Lord cared for you and chose you, for you were the smallest of all nations. No, it was because the Lord loved you and stood by his oath to your forefathers, Genesis 15, that he brought you out with his strong hand and redeemed you from the land of slavery, from the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Know then that the Lord your God is God, the faithful God, with those who love him and keep his commandments. He keeps covenant and faith for 1,000 generations. But those who defy him and show their hatred for him, he repays with destruction. He will not be slow to requite any who so hate him. So let me conclude with a note of caution in relation really to the last verse of this particular passage. The covenant can also be narrowed so that the relationship between the partners that includes these partners into a wholeness and mutuality of life becomes exclusion for those who are not part of that covenant. And I'm sure that many of you will understand this observation. This inclusive, exclusive character of the covenant understanding has also brought much sorrow and hurt both on Jews and Christians. For one thing, Jews, covenanted people of God, excluded Christians, another covenanted people of God. But the Christians were just the same way. They tended to exclude the Jews, the old covenanted people of God, for the sake of their new covenant. But that leads me over to the themes that I would like to discuss with you tomorrow and on Wednesday. Now, it is just about time to conclude this. But there, we can have one or two questions. Yes, please.
I was wondering, is the word covenant ever used to describe a marital relationship between men and women in the Old Testament?
Yes. Not to my knowledge. Not to my knowledge, but the prophet Hosea describes the relationship between God and his people in terms of a marriage relationship. And when you look more closely, you see that there are many parallels to this. In other words, that the marriage relationship and the covenant relationship may indeed illuminate each other. Let me refer you to chapter 7, I think, in this book, Covenants, Biblical and Contemporary, where Rosemary Ruther in chapter 8 has a very illuminating chapter, Marriage as a Sign of the Covenant.
Thank you.
Good question. One more question? Yes, please.
Could you explain a little further the degree that a covenant is reciprocal? It seems to me that this is God making it with Abraham.
Yes.
Is Abraham doing something back?
Yes. This varies. In fact, if you were to catalog or to categorize the covenants of which the Old Testament speaks, you would have to divide them into covenant of reciprocity, where both partners bind each other to the other. They are equals. And covenants, and these are covenants between emperors and their vassals, or the God of Israel and his people, where the covenant relationship still makes the relation between the two secure, but it is an unequal relationship. The emperor dictates to the vassal, God grants to Israel the covenant. Even the vocabulary is different. And this then will shift the understanding of the covenant toward a covenant understanding that makes it primarily a one-sided thing. One-sided in the sense that there is an active partner and a passive partner. Both we observe in the Old Testament. And I think I will have to say more about this tomorrow too. Well, friends, thank you very much. Come back tomorrow morning.
Thank you.